All right, so our next presentation this morning moves away from the mining theme, but does give us an opportunity to recognize MGWA's latest white paper on the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act, which was just published last week. And it is available now on the MGWA website. And this white paper was several years in the making, was quite an ambitious effort that culminated in what I think is a very comprehensive and informative publication, if you've had a chance to look at it. And I did want to take a minute just to recognize the team that contributed to the publication, including authors Jim Lundy, Gretchen Sable, and Jim Stark, work group members Kara Dennis, Christine Close, Laurel Reeves, and Brian Stenquist, and committee liaisons David Christman and Carrie Jennings. And also a special thanks to Sean Hunt for doing all the formatting and preparation of the paper for recent publication. So with that, David Christman is gonna come forward and do a presentation summary of the white paper. And then following David's presentation, Jared Trost will do a presentation from the white paper committee and talk a little bit about the next white paper on groundwater data, which is just beginning development. So with that, I'll turn it over to David.
I'm actually going to just speak for a few minutes and do mostly procedural, and then I'm going to, oh, thank you. And then we'll turn it over to Gretchen, Jim Lundy, and Jim Stark to really get into the meat of the white paper. I should have gotten that procedural instruction before starting. We started the project in 2019, and certainly if anyone would have mentioned the word pandemic around the table, you would have had many puzzled looks. But we did get some in-person interviews started in 2020, and then we went to virtual meetings later in the year. That allowed us to scope the project a little tighter, or refine the scope, and then we went into writing later in 2020. And we have been in review for quite a long time. We transitioned in summer of 2021 to reviewing, and we got early reviews. We got early reviews from Jeff Stoner and Carrie Jennings, which we really appreciated and helped get started on that process of looking at text. The normal white paper process is you go through two rounds of review of the white paper committee and the MGWA board. We wanted to go and develop a public draft. So after the initial round of white paper committee and board, we took the text to the interagency groundwater drinking water team, which is comprised of managers from the state water agencies. It was important to get their input because we were really talking about state programs and state rules. So they provided some crucial information, which we got back earlier this year, and we began the rewrite and edit process and reached the final product this fall for publication. So here's the list of current white papers and the one that's in progress right now. So the Groundwater Protection Act joins that list. So the next bit of time here, Gretchen's going to talk about what is in the act and the organization of the white paper. Then Jim Lundy will talk about the findings which are presented in section 4. And Jim Stark will, if there's time for question and answers, we'll go through the question and answer portion. We will leave time for Jared Trost to give you an update on the white paper committee work and the data white paper, which is in progress. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Gretchen.
Well, some of us can remember the 80s, others of us can only imagine, right? But things that were going on then that led up to passage of this act was, you know, Minnesota's population had grown quite a bit. We saw large increases in numbers of industries and water use, and we began to realize that groundwater was being permanently contaminated and wasn't infinite. We had Superfund sites like Riley Tar, the Twin Cities Arsenal, happening, and we didn't have tools to deal with them. The Clean Water Act passed in Congress, but there was no groundwater provisions in the Clean Water Act, and so we didn't have tools that came to us from the feds. We also had major advances in chemical analysis that allowed us to find things that we had no idea were there. Volatile organics, pesticides, all kinds of things that we found in water, had no idea were there. So, and then we also had a drought. The drought of 1988 put the water intakes in Minneapolis and St. Paul in jeopardy. So that was a big deal, and it led to a bipartisan law that passed in 1989. That's Governor Perpich in the middle signing the act. And to his left, on the left is Steve Morse, and on the right is Senator Steve Morse, and on the right is Representative Willard Munger. So it was a quite an effort. The act was very broad in scope, and I'm not going to go through all that, but I do have some resources for if you want to learn more. I actually gave a talk on this in spring of 2018 at the groundwater at this conference, and you can find that posted by looking on our website here, or also our little team did a webinar last week, and we did an updated version of what was in the act and how it's implemented today. So if you want to find that, it's posted on a website that I run for a League of Women Voters thing called UMRRGWPA. So if you look Upper Mississippi River Region and Groundwater Protection Act, you'll find it that way. So you can look at those. What's in the white paper? Well, we start off with a dedication, because we lost two of our major water leaders here, John Hella and Deb Swackhammer, during the time that this was being produced. And so we do dedicate the white paper to those two. We provide a timeline that starts back in the, 1870s. So you can think way back with your way back machine and take a look at kind of what led to where we are today. We also have documentation of things that were in the act, and it required action by different state agencies, and have those actions been complete? So it's kind of like a report card. Here are the things they were required to do. Did they get them done? So that we provide that there so you can see how things have been implemented. We describe major areas where groundwater sustainability can be improved, and that's what Jim's going to talk about here in a minute. That's part four. I want to recognize that we did interview a large number of people for this. These were virtual interviews because it was that time. So we talked to Representative Gene McGinnis, Representative Rick Hansen, John Helland and John Wells, Gene Miriam, Ron Nargang, Jay Frischman, Jason Meckel, Greg Buzicki and Dan Stoddard, Don Jakes and John Linkstein, Roger Renner and Dave Kill, Jeff Broberg and Bruce Olson, Kelton Barr, Bob Carls, and Ray Wolo. And so all these people, you can see we had a mix of retired and unretired people, and it was good to get both past and current perspectives, so thanks to all them. Another resource in the white paper is a table that shows all the provisions of the act with their current citations in law. Some parts never change, other parts changed almost every year, so you can see kind of how they've morphed. And we also have a column in this table that looks at the impact of Clean Water Act funding. Because without the Clean Water Legacy money, so much of this act wouldn't have been able to be completed. So that was a major thing. And also Appendix C then, water governance is a big question. We're always hearing talked, we need a water agency. Is there too many state agencies involved in water? So we took a little look at that, and we have some resources for you there. That's appendix. There's the conclusions are in the appendix. And if you click the link in the document online, it'll take you off to more resources. So you have ways to get in depth on that topic if you want to. So now I'll hand it off to Jim, and he's going to talk about the findings.
left myself too long a walk there. Thanks, Gretchen, for setting it up. She talked about the history leading up to the passage of the Act and then the actions that have happened as a result of having the Act. I'm going to talk about what we call Section 4 of the White Paper, which talks about more about the future. I think we can agree that today, if you think back to 1989, which some of us here can, not everybody, because not everybody was born yet, but if we think back to that world, that was a different world than we got now. It's a whole new world. It's been 33 years. That's pretty much a third of a century, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. So why would it be the same? We've got, we have to think now about climate change. We have environmental issues that have changed in the last 33 years. Water use has increased, both irrigated water and drinking water. Technology has improved, so now we can see more contaminants, identify them, and quantify them in groundwater. We have an improved understanding of the interrelationships between what we're doing on the land and the effects of water quality, so we can come up with solutions to the problems. There have been legislative changes, changes in the law, and also, importantly, there have been funding changes. In order to manage water into the future, the White Paper is making the case that it really kind of centers around sustainability. So if we're going to see continued change of the type that we've seen in the last third of a century, or the next third of a century or more, we're going to have to manage water with sustainability in mind. And where we land in the paper that we've presented is to emphasize three priority actions that we can take. The first is concerned with ensuring stable funding. The second is to use groundwater sustainability as a driver for our management of groundwater policy and activities. And the third involves minor revisions to water governance. Priority action one, ensure stable funding. Maybe not everybody knows, but before the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment was passed and became active in 2008, much of the activity that we do in groundwater was funded differently than it is today. It was funded through what's known as the general fund. But when the amendment funding became available, that became the funding source for much of what's being done in groundwater these days, and the general funding strings have gone elsewhere. So they're no longer available to us. So when this amendment sunsets in 2034, if nothing else changes, all that funding goes away and groundwater activities have to stop. So that's a problem. We're going to have to start now to plan for that funding gap that we can predict. Priority action two is continue focusing on letting sustainability be our guide in terms of groundwater policy and management. We actually have a definition in statute of sustainability, and what it says is two things. Well, it says a lot of things, but the two main things are groundwater use must be sustainably managed to supply the needs of future generations. So we have to think of the future. The other thing that it says is that groundwater use must be managed so as not to harm ecosystems, degrade water, or reduce water levels. And this is thinking beyond, we accept the reduction of water levels having to do with providing drinking water for private and public supplies. Well, that's a nice definition, but it's pretty general, and it's pretty difficult for an agency to use that to guide their specific activities, and it would be really hard for a program to use that to guide their specific activities. So one of the things that the White Paper suggests is that we come up with practical sustainability definitions or operational definitions that can be used to perform the everyday work that groundwater programs have to manage. And this would allow us to do the things in the bullet items here. We can use that approach to integrate sustainability assessments into agency water management programs. We can use that to assure sustainable drinking water sources, coordinate policy between land use and groundwater quality. We can assess proposals that seem to come up once in a while There was one a couple years ago to pump a lot of groundwater from a Minnesota aquifer and export it to a drier state. And this is clearly not in line with the sustainability management that we want to do, but we have to, you know, we have to kind of think about in the future when these kinds of proposals come up, how are we going to manage that? We can use this approach to respond to contaminants of emerging concern. We can use, we can make sure that we're pivoting towards effective technological innovations that help us. Instead of throwing up obstacles, we can kind of use the useful part of technical innovations. And we can continue to improve our data collection and serving out of data to support sustainability assessments. And we can also, if we do that, then we can manage groundwater quantity based on water budgets. That's assuming we have the data to support that kind of assessment, recharge, discharge, storage. And we can also think in terms of, I mean, and we're already doing this, but continue to do this, manage groundwater quality based on standards, and especially develop our ideas about what are unacceptable effects and where those thresholds should be. So that will be a continuing effort that we'll have to maintain. Priority action three has to do with groundwater or with water governance. And Gretchen mentioned this term, and what it refers to is how water programs are implemented at the agency scale. So what we have in Minnesota is, depending on how you count, 5 or 6 or 7 or maybe even 8 water agencies. And all of the functions of groundwater management are spread out among those agencies according to basic, you know, subtopics. That's one way to manage, and there are some benefits and some difficulties presented by that management approach. There's another idea that maybe that comes up every now and then. We should combine all of the water activities into a single Department of Water, and we can anticipate some benefits to that, but also some problems. The benefits might be around efficiencies, but we might lose some beneficial competition of ideas between agencies and programs by doing that. And it would be a funding nightmare. So we have to kind of proactively consider that issue and see what we might do. In the white paper, we state that probably it's we might want to kind of not upset the cart too much right now. Keep the agency, you know, the multi-agency approach, but increase the coordination so that efficiency can be improved. And there's some models for this. The interagency coordinating team exists now, and that's a set of, I believe it's a group of assistant commissioners of the water agencies who meet regularly to discuss problems, and they have sub-teams reporting to them about the details of what's going on. And this has really increased the cooperation between the agencies and the efficiency in their ability to turn projects around and deliver results. And so the white paper suggests that this is something that should be increased and something that should continue into the future so that we can continue to improve. And I'll turn it over to Jim Stark now for questions.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for being here. My colleagues have done a really good job of summarizing a lot of work that was done on this effort, and now it's time for some questions. Right hand, Daryl. Okay, time for your questions. We just have a few minutes here. So the Act is over 30 years old. This white paper review was driven by suggestions that it was time to review and maybe revise the Act. The white paper presents that review. You've heard that in the recommendation. For these recommendations to go anywhere, it would need to result in actions at the legislature or within the agencies. As you know, the Minnesota Groundwater Association is not an advocacy organization. It's not a lobbying organization. So if those would be were going to be moved forward, it would have to be done by some other process. So we're asking for your comments. You've heard the recommendations, and we really would like you to help us in the next couple of minutes tell us how you think, what if you have comments, suggestions, or if you have recommendations on moving this process forward. We have some time for questions. I know just a couple minutes, so your lunch will be as cold as you probably are right now, and we don't want that to happen. So we have time for a couple questions. I'll ask the members to come up. I see Carrie's hand raised.
My question is whether it's legislation or rulemaking that's needed, because if it's really operational direction for the agencies, it seems like that could be handled through rulemaking instead, and that would keep the act safe.
Good question, and I think generally we agree with you that the act may need some tweaking here or there, but in general, we certainly don't want to reinvent or revise the act. And many of the activities could be accomplished by rulemaking and activities within the agencies.
I have a follow-up question. How are you defining sustainability, and what kind of parameters are you putting into your definition of sustainability?
Another good question. Sustainability is actually defined in statute, and maybe one of the members can recite that if they want to come up here, but it's basically, it involves doing no harm. So that's defined by statute. I think the paper suggests that an operational definition would be needed for all the agencies to help them carry out the intent of that short definition. Jeff.
Jim? I'm right here, Jim. Paul, over here. Can you see me? There we are. Great. Well, first of all, I think the water train solves a sustainability issue for the people in Arizona. So, you know, we'll have to figure that one out.
Good point.
But in terms of funding, you mentioned Clean Water Fund. That is very important. But, of course, the Environmental Natural Resource Trust Fund sunsets in a couple years, 2024, I think, December. And that provides about $70 million a year for projects that most of us would consider part of our interest in groundwater and so forth. And although it's different than the Clean Water Fund because it is a trust fund with $1 billion that will keep generating annual projects, what we have to watch for as politically active geologists is the transitioning of where that money is used. There's been a lot of efforts to use the Environmental Natural Resource Trust Fund for things that weren't originally intended. So this is more of a just sort of keep your ears up about those kind of things that are going to happen. People are going to want to get their hands on that money, and they might try to reallocate that in the coming years. So
yeah, thanks, Paul. Good point. And the trust fund is very important, particularly for research. I know that there are efforts among the environmental agencies to ensure that something happens in the legislature, and it's an active process, and I think I'm hopeful that that will be very successful. Jeff.
Yeah, where does the public fit in to the act? We have an existing act, and there's not many places that the public can play a role. Does the new proposal increase that, and when will private well owners get a voice?
Good point. And within the act, under that sustainability objective, there are some calls for increased education, increased citizen involvement in the process. So it's a good point. It's a tough nut to crack.
Is it a one-way street, though? I mean, it seems like we're at risk of defaulting to an agency-only vision.
I would hope not, but certainly that's something we ought to discuss. And, you know, this has been, the white paper has been presented to a subcommittee in the legislature. Some of the topics that body is considering deal with water education and citizen involvement. And our job, I guess, as citizens is to convince those legislators that that's important. And that will take the work of a lot of people and a lot of organizations, and I hope we can carry that through. I think the work that's being done with private well testing by MNRU and this organization are a really great way to get that word out and to try to ask for some of those suggestions from citizens. I believe we're out of time. Maybe one more question if we have one. I guess not. So with that, I think Jared Trost with the U.S. Geological Survey is going to come talk about the next white paper, which I'm sure they will complete more in a more timely way than this one was done. So thank you.
Well, I can still say this. Good morning, everyone. And I was just thinking, you know, we've seen a lot of things about how things are always changing here. So I was thinking about our committee and how maybe we'll have to change the name, because in 50 years, will people know what white paper is? I'm part of this committee, and here are the current members on the committee. You saw some of them presenting already, but we oversee the white paper preparation. It's a long process from somebody who has an idea. They submit a proposal, and then we select an idea, and then solicit interest, find a leader to put together a white paper working group, and then that's how these white papers come into existence. And what are white papers? So you just heard a great presentation about the latest and greatest white paper. And so it's a neutral, science-based evaluation of a groundwater-related topic. We've had discussion in our white paper group about updating some of the past white papers. That's an interesting idea. We haven't really done that yet. But each of the white papers that have come out, they're prepared by, you know, by you guys, by groundwater professionals who are MGWA members. And they're published online in summary form. And there are references and so forth included. And the white papers are owned by MGWA. And so you already saw a slide similar to this one that listed the white papers that MGWA has produced. And if you would like to read them, they are on the webpage. The current white paper that we are working on is just affectionately titled Groundwater Data. I guess just raise your hand if you use groundwater data. All right, great. So this one should be applicable to everybody here. And so we've got a great working group. It's a little bit larger working group than some of the past papers. But I think we've had some great discussions already. The tricky thing is defining a reasonable scope for what is groundwater data. I guess I can leave that with you. When you go for lunch, you can have that discussion at your table. What is groundwater data? And our objectives, we're going to focus on observational data. Such as hydraulic characteristics, temperature, water levels, water use. We're going to try to avoid water quality, because that's a whole big, giant, I won't say mess, but it's too much for one white paper. So we're going to focus on more of the physical characteristics and quantity and flow. And so we want to characterize a present groundwater data economy, thinking of producers and consumers of data, and develop forward-looking ideas to improve our data economy. And so just to give you a heads up, it's fast forwarding to the bottom line, I don't want you to lose any sleep waiting for just another email for you to fill out a survey, but we're developing a survey right now, and the goals are to understand, you know, which we produce a lot of data in the state, which data are being used, how are the data being used, and then where could improvements be made. So we want to get your input as groundwater professionals in the state of Minnesota. And I will say, if anybody, you can come talk to me or find us through the webpage. If anybody has any expertise in survey design to help us ask good questions that we can extract information from, we'd certainly be open to talking with you and having you take a look at our survey before it goes out prime time. And if you have if you have ideas for future white paper topics, this slide just tells you how to go about that. And I would like to point out, you know, glamour, recognition, fame, and opportunities to meet with real people and talk about groundwater topics of your interest. So thank you for your time, and find me afterwards or shoot me an email if you want to talk more.